Would you introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Gareth Sager.
Hello, I'm Mark Stewart from the Pop Group.
So let's get some of the obvious stuff that we already know. Let's see, first record in 35 years. That's the first thing. Well, I know about the Rip Band. I know about the solo stuff. But what people really want to know is somewhere between then and now, there's some pivotal things in 35 friggin' years.
I made a pretty good album I like by a band called Pregnant that's called Unusual Lover that has some pretty comedic moments on it and some pretty intense moments on it. That's very obscure, that album.
And can people find that record?
I don't think so, no.
So you've done the YouTube search and no one's bootlegged it?
There is a Pop Group connection. The guy that did all the Pop Group artwork, Rich Beale, is a singer on that album.
I got to work with Kenneth Anger, who's an absolute, total and utter hero of mine. And we were in LA last night and I was hanging out in all different areas, which Kenneth has made very, very famous. And one of the real pleasures of being in a band is to get to sit next to Sun Ra, work with Kenneth Anger, work with Richard Hell. You know, those are the moments that I really value.
You call yourself the Pop Group back then. You're doing what you're doing. There's a little bit of sense of irony there, conceivably. But so many people spend a lot of time now saying, well, maybe the Pop Group's now gone pop. The goal isn't really about becoming pop. The goal is you had something more to say, I would imagine.
Well, I think that more we had to say, we wanted it to be popular. We wanted to be as big as anybody else could be. We weren't interested in being weird underground cult fetish band. We were most definitely wanted a, just, you know, we didn't, we were maybe just too extreme, but we didn't feel we were too extreme in any way. We just thought we were the next thing after the Sex Pistols, really, you know?
And when you're talking about the next thing after the Sex Pistols, I mean, the Sex Pistols were a flash. I mean, people only listen to one Sex Pistols record, right?
That's right, yeah.
But look at the efficacy and the legacy of that one thing and how it supposedly affected punk.
Well,
it made punk popular, right?
It did, but in a very stereotyped way. And we thought we were taking it into a completely new territory, which... what we thought punk advocated was you could do absolutely anything and combine absolutely anything. And I think that was really what, and it still is what we're really all about.
Well, yeah.
That sense of risk. Personally, I've always drawn from this French crew called the Situationists. And we had this idea of an explosion in the heart of the commodity. And we learned from Malcolm McLaren would use like even press releases as kind of little manifestos and the texture of the paper. I mean, everything is for a reason, really. And that reason is to question things. And we're constantly questioning things. And the most important thing I think about the Pop Group, and we do it to ourselves, is to deconstruct and tear off the masks that have been imposed on us since an early age and try and really find out who you are and break down the conditioning and not become a zombie.
The thing that people always spend so much time talking about is a band is coming back, right? And these guys are this age and... an aesthetic doesn't change with that by any stretch of anyone's imagination. We're sitting here, we're not exactly kids, but we kind of know what we're talking about. And in some ways, having that age gives you the knowledge base to be even, excuse the expression, in quotes, more punk, right?
Yeah, well, Ornette Coleman had this saying that you had to learn everything in order to unlearn everything and play something new. But these days, the spread of interest in different forms of music, I mean... you know, like Cecil Taylor, who we're trying to get to play with us in New York, he's like 88. And I know kids of like, I've met people who got into the Pop Group when they're 8 years old. Right. Do you know what I mean? I was talking to Mike Watts from the Minutemen, and he was getting into the Pop Group when he was like 14, 15. I was really starting to consume serious music at the age of 12. So the spread across what people listen to, you know, thank God, those kind of genre boxes and genre coffins, I call them, have really broken down, and people have got a really eclectic mix of taste of music these days from, you know, across the board.
Well, in those genre coffins, every single article I read, the current ones, they, in order of appearance, well, they were a mix of dub, funk, jazz, and then avant-garde, and they use all these terms.
What the hell? Avant-garde,
but that's what I'm saying. I just read one here.
Somebody might have been avant-garde in the prehistoric days. Somebody farting or something.
A caveman, right?
Yeah.
Was
There was a guy called Le Petain who, in the 1890s, who played the, who farted the French national anthem, you know.
That's avant-garde. But the other thing that's really kind of fun coming back after all this time, that instead of people talking about your influences, they can talk about who you influenced.
Yeah.
Because the list of human beings that you've influenced, and we're not going to go down those names, is phenomenal.
And that is a strange feeling, again, because the funniest thing is, me and Gareth particularly, really, really, really fight to defend our naivety, right? And this idea of the kind of idiot savant, and this playful childlike behavior, where I think the magic comes from, you know. And then so basically in my head, I'm still that 12, 13 year old boy who had some kind of epiphany on the way home from school that it felt like somebody opened the top of my head with a can opener. I don't know what it was. I don't know what happened. But that moment, my whole life changed. The world became multicolor, and I could even feel the atoms in people's eyes, you know. And that isn't really anything to do with music. That's just something that happened. And it's like that every day. As soon as I open my eyes, it's full on.
Again, quotes, populist black music, right? So populist black music, which has been used in several articles recently, you know, well, they brought it to the forefront, and I'm thinking, is that James Brown? Is that Shalimar? Is that Northern Soul? Is that, right?
Sometimes the kind of museumification, anthropology kind of way people look at jazz. I mean, jazz is a dance music.
Right? Sure.
And the way they say that, you know, certain experimental noise things is like really pushing the edge. When from a kid, from a very early age, I heard amazing experimentation and whole new planets being created on the dubs of amazing Jamaican records. I heard the most mental edit, backwards, forwards editing techniques on Ted Moulton remix things and on stuff coming out of the garage. And, you know, because at the moment I'm hearing crazy spatial hypersonics in some really mad, what we call noir and B. There's a guy called Hudson Mohawk Patterns or whatever on the Y record. Suddenly, me and Gareth are like messing about, like putting machines backwards, putting copycats in, ran alien, back engineering alien technology. And then Dennis made a whole dub album out of sounds from his body, right, at one stage. But we'd be in the studio and we'd be doing multiple mixes and then cutting the mixes on little bits of tape stuck on the wall. It looked like a weird kind of music concrete thing. And then repeating the same before sampling or everything. So it's like, you know, again, it's that playfulness. And we were going to call this new album The Island of Lost Toys, because the studio we got in that Paul Epworth had just built is, in fact, one of the best studios in the whole world. You two were in there the day before, right? And for me and Gareth, it was like being on the island of lost toys. But we could actually, like when they put like Bugs Bunny's head on like a motorized spider or something, we could mutate and rewire it, you know. And the studio's there to be abused. Like Pete Townsend smashed a guitar or something. We have exactly the same attitude in the studio. And there was an immense pleasure in smashing up, crashing up, cutting up, juxtaposing amazing gear.
Again, back after 35 years, it's not, this is a continuation. Sure, you broke up for the reasons that so many bands break up. You did a bunch of different things. And then you said, you know what? The spirit's still there. It's time to come back. But it's a continuation. It's not, oh, it's a new thing.
For me, it's like a real, it's a challenge. I mean, you know, the year before I took on this pop group mantle again, I was doing a solo thing, which was crashing whole other personalities like Kenneth Anger, Richard Hell, Daddy G from Massive Attack, Factory Floor, and just using these people as kind of characters in a soundscape, right? And I thought, right, can I work with my friends from back in the day as like an art commission, instead of like going to work with Keith Levine or some Balinese like shadow puppet guy in some art space in Vancouver or whatever, can I use my friends and the skills I knew they had and the new beings that they are new, is this going to be an interesting commission, right? And I thought about it, The original thing came through Matt Groening from The Simpsons, who turned out to be a huge fan.
Right there, right. Who in 2010 invited you to all tomorrow's parties.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And that kind of support from amazing people across the world is fundamental to the band, because for me, punk rock is a community. We started in the audience, we finish in the audience, and we are those kids that saw Paul Simonon from The Clash with stickers on his bass, showing him where to put his fingers. That enabled us, right? If we enable other people like Nick Cave, Bjork, Massive Attack, Nine Inch Nails, if we open doors into territories that they run off and create whole new genres from one pop group, five new genres supposedly were created in one pop group song. That's by the by to me. I'm constantly thinking about the next kind of mutation I can do with Chicago footwork, with Japanese noise, with like intergalactic horns. You know, for me, at the moment, the possibilities of hypersonic sound, of weaponizing hypersonic sound, is more interesting than Bitcoin.
But has Trent Reznor ever said to you, oh, by the way, do you remember when I handed you my demo? I mean, have you had this discussion?
No, I've never met Trent. Well, apart from when he handed me the demo.
But I mean, when you look back on that, that's, you know, again, when you get to a certain age, you look back on the things you've done and the things you've affected. Gosh, do you think Trent wakes up in the morning and goes, you know, there was a moment that I was handing somebody a demo across, you know, and now I'm me? I mean, and then looking at you and you're not even thinking about it?
It is a bizarre story, but again, we were not interested in being, the whole point
of... You weren't trying to be any of that.
We're not interested in being, we're anti-star. The whole point is using these channels to communicate information and the purpose being for radical social change.
Okay, so your anti-starness, though, if you're going to be the pop group and you are going to have a producer that's a fan, then Paul Epworth would be that. When you have 12 days and you walk into a studio like that, that's...
We've done lots of preparation. Me and Gareth have been writing the material from the minute we've reformed. We said when we reformed, one and all, the most important thing is to make new material, but not try to replicate anything from the past and not try to be enchained by any kind of legacy, to experiment and take risks in whichever way. And for us to work with a producer like Paul Epworth, for me, was a real flip, right? It would be incredibly easy for us to make the most out there, avant-garde, death jazz record and blow people's heads away. We have that ability. If I have any ability in my life, right?
You can do that.
And we could have played the underground art festivals across the world and be Mr. Weird, right? But I think it's very, very important now for people of a conscious mentality to stand up and be counted. Because with the rise of the right across Europe and huge problems across the world, where like the 14 richest people in the world own more than the 150 billion poorest, it's a crazy situation we're in now, right? And the alternative has to make itself shown. But as I'm traveling, I'm realizing that this alternative, these conscious people, is a vast swathe, but it's just kind of disconnected, and it's a greedy kind of right-wing bully boy. He's always rushed to the floor, like in the music business, the blaggers and
what
stuff.
What Paul said was that the pop group albums and some of my solo productions completely and utterly blew his brains when he was starting as a producer, right? And it changed the way he saw the production process, right? And so he was thinking that working with us, that we would be like impossible to understand. Some people are two or three steps out of this reality, and sometimes it's difficult to connect back into the other reality. But Paul was, like I'm saying, he just bought all this amazing gear. He wanted us to christen his studio. We were using all the best facilities. And he was more excited than anybody to be free, because some of the productions he has to do, He has to put a tie on and act a bit normal, you know. And one of the graphics on the Citizen Zombie label is this fist coming through where a head would have been, with like a suit and tie. And I'm finding that like some really amazing people, when they know the pop group are back, people on American TV shows, Japanese film people, really cool cult performance queer theory artists like Bruce LaBruce, Aisha Argento,
loads of other bands, they're just like ripping off and saying, yes, we're post-punk secret agents, right, and we want it, and we're going to help you. And that's that sympathy and that thing. And for me, the pop group has become a flag under which freaks can gather, and somehow it's symbolized a kind of a freedom of thought, which I'm not worthy to carry that mantle, but I'm really happy that it exists. When I was young, Throbbing Gristle was that band, right? And the audience was more important than the band. You'd end up meeting really freaky, like, you know, out there outsider people at the audiences, and you'd see people talking, and that was the church.
In this day and age, is all these devices we use and social media, which, you know, you could, social media used properly is to the greater good. Social media used badly is the Gestapo, in my opinion. Yeah. So how much do you pay attention? I mean, have you modernized that part?
I'm interested in social media in like hacktivism as a means of change, right? I've studied, you know, there was this uprising in East Timor when it was the first kind of use of a kind of electronic intifada, an electronic underground of like Samizdat dissident publications. So, and for me, there's a lot of idealists on the electronic frontiers, and it was kind of set up as a kind of free library. So that access to all different kinds of information. I mean, I personally love Twitter. I can bounce about. I can go into Chomsky's Twitter. I can go into, like I'm saying, Bruce LaBruce's Twitter. And suddenly I'm on this site called Non, which is all like queer carnival theory. And then I've got some kind of, that I'm zoning down through this extreme French 18th century literature and finding these demented guys like further down the Huisman. And I don't know how it happens, but people are chucking stuff up there, and you can bounce about and find all sorts of stuff. It's great.
Okay, so just because part of my mission in life is to destroy things that destroy, in a bad way.
Good.
So what about this clown from, and I get to say it because I do this with a lot of bands when I find this, what about this clown from Pitchfork who reviews the album and says things that he thinks are incendiary, but in the end, and I'll just read you, I'll read you my favorite one. They're back from the dead with no real purpose or direction, and they're just stumbling around dumbly. The result of so much suspicion is an album that's somehow loud and timid, all clamor and no soul, right? And then this guy gives you a 2.5, but then in his bio it says he's very proud of the fact that he's only given a 110 rating in 9 years. So his version of the role of the critic, right, is not to give his opinion. Because this is, it's to, again, so how do we as people who can get the word out without trying to control, how do we fix this part?
Again, this is one of the, I'm not talking about that thing specifically, but this is one of the reasons why I think it's crucial this year more than anything for conscious people to stand up, because I've got this saying that it only takes for good people to do nothing for evil to prevail, right? And you can't just stand on the sidelines tutting. You have to engage with reality. This world, we are full, we're all entangled objects. My shoes are made in China. My girlfriend's from Iran. No. You can't sit in isolation and be separatist and tut on the sidelines. Something that we do here in the West has an effect in the South. It's our greed that is creating these problems, right? The resource wars, the false flag attacks, the proxies. It's crazy what's going on.
And that's the definition of punk in the long run, is it not?
Yeah.
I'm going to have you build a musical sandwich. And what that is two songs on the outside from the pop group, and then a bunch of songs by anybody else in between.
Okay.